Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to the Ghibliotech, the podcast that sings the praises of one of the world's greatest animation studios, Studio Ghibli. I'm Michael Leader.
And I'm Steph Watts, and we've heard the lot of them.
And after 4 years of waiting, I'm Jake Cunningham, and so have I.
So join us in our musical quest into the glorious world of Ghibli. Jake, Steph, welcome back. Jake, you did say there's been a wait. It has been a while since we've been all on the microphone, though, together, hasn't it?
Well, Puffin Rock, wasn't it?
Maybe not 3 years.
One of the best films of the year.
3 months, maybe.
Yeah. But it's nice to be back. And what a moment to come back to. It does feel like a perfect moment to re-commune, because it was, of course, a great moment of commune that brought us together last week as well, which was the Joe Hisaishi concert at Wembley, I think first put on our radar at the back end of 2019.
Yes. Going back and looking at emails about this, the last email was like February 2020, and then suddenly there was silence. Because, yes, this was the symphonic tour that so many people were excited about, and then something happened in 2020 that meant that it was delayed. How many times was it delayed in the end? Was it 3 times, Steph? 2 times?
I think I've lost count. I think maybe twice?
Because it was
delayed. And then
delayed,
rescheduled for COVID.
Yeah.
Because he had COVID for one of them.
Yes.
Joe Hisaishi, poor guy. But then it was just delayed because of just general travel problems because of the global shutdown around the pandemic. And yeah, I can't think of, you know, another instance where there's been such a delay where when you finally get to go to a concert, you're immediately reflective about the person you were however many years before, the things that have changed in those years, where you are now, where you were then. So already for what was going to be an emotional night with Joe Hisaishi with an orchestra playing through the bangers and the hits of the Studio Ghibli or Hayao Miyazaki catalogue, it was already going to be an emotional night, but then there was an extra existential weight of finally doing this and saluting your 2019/2020 self in the process.
Well, yeah, because when we first heard about this, I think we would have just come back from Japan. So at that point, we hadn't even done any podcasts that were beyond Studio Ghibli. Like, we were still firmly a Ghibli podcast.
That's mad. And in sort of time-honoured Twitter meme fashion, you could probably go through the many things that have happened in the time that we've been waiting for this concert. Thing businesses that have gone out. So Wilco's gone out of business. An Avatar sequel
Quibi
has been released
fantastic.
Finally. Earwig and the Witch was released. All these things. It was so. Let's try and think back to where we were circa 2019, 2020. We knew that Joe was coming to town. We knew that this music was going to be performed on such a scale. What were we hoping for? What were we? I mean, I know. I don't know if I'm fully in the minority here, but I know, Jake, you are much more invested on the music side than I am. I've heard you talk about this many times about how you've got a great line, haven't you, about how in some ways the music is a greater part of your life per minute than the films because you've listened to it so much.
Yeah. Absolutely. I would hazard a guess and say that number is tenfold. The amount of time that I've spent with Ghibli's music, and majority of the time Joe Hisaishi's music, is that much more than the time I've spent with Ghibli's films. Because and especially during the pandemic, once it went up on Spotify, and all of a sudden you could have a whole day at home and the only thing that you listen to are these albums. And I'm going through a big patch of that right now as well. And it is a funny one where if the concert had been at its original time for 2020, I wouldn't have had those years spending more time with the music. So, of course, there is the delayed gratification of just the event being delayed and finally getting there. But the reward of being able to see that music that I've subsequently spent that much more time with made it incredibly impactful and quite stirring and emotional. And as you say, Michael, it's not just that connection with the music. You're already kind of walking back in time when you hear it and imagining the concert that might have been and the concert that we ended up with.
You've just touched on something there that I hadn't actually thought of before. So if we would have seen this in 2020, you would have only been 18 months at most into your Ghibli journey.
Hmm.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's a difference between almost seeing a band on their first album tour and revisiting one of your all-time favourites and greats.
You're making me think of James Murphy doing some kind of lineup for this. I was there when Joe Hisaishi first put on his Wembley concert. I was there 3 years later when it finally happened.
I love how niche that reference is to the LCD sound system fans out there. Steph, you must have been hyped for this. Were you hyped for seeing Joe in concert?
I think this has just been pushed back so often that it just came up on me. And I don't remember being aware of it in 2019. I think I've just erased 2 years of memories from my brain, because I fully don't remember this even coming up until last year when we got tickets when it got rescheduled. So this has been an interesting one where I think, like Jake, throughout the pandemic I listened to more of the music, invested in a couple of nice Ghibli vinyls. So they're kind of on while I'm working quite a lot. And I think overall I appreciated it more because I was looking forward to certain pieces and films kind of popping up than if we'd gone in 2020, where it probably would have just washed over me in a different way. Excited about 2 days in the lead up when I realised it was finally happening and could actually get excited for it. It's a strange one.
It is. Well, and even though I characterise myself as being more of the films than the music has always been an important part of it. And my sort of long Ghibli journey, my friend Nick, who was was very much there from the beginning of the journey, he had seen Castle in the Sky before I even knew what Ghibli was and before he even really knew how deep the rabbit hole went. And he was obsessed with the soundtrack. And he had the symphonic soundtrack and the synthesizer soundtrack for Castle in the Sky. And we were obsessed with certain motifs from the synthesizer score. The tiger moth motif in particular is one that we still talk to each other about now and then. I remember when he went out to Japan, I think it must have been after university, he went to the museum and came back with a case full of Ghibli stuff. He mostly came back with piano sheet music as well. He was really, really into the music. So it was quite special for me to actually bump into him before the concert as it started. But so it's always been there for me. And I think that's another thing, really, that they probably couldn't have really predicted, because of course this tour had been going on for some time before that. We'd seen video clips. We've seen Joe and the rapturous applause that he receives on this tour. We have friends who've seen these concerts in Prague and elsewhere. So they're nothing new, but I'm sure in this gap between this hiatus, the Ghibli films being on Netflix, the scores being more available via Spotify, can only help create that love, that familiarity that on a scale that they couldn't have had previously. So this all leads up to, as we record, last Friday night. You say it's at Wembley, Jake. It's confusing. There are two Wembley venues right next to each other, right at the same tube station. And the previous gig I'd been to in the area was at Wembley Stadium, as in the famous football stadium. Saw Electric Light Orchestra there a few years ago. In fact, with Nick, the guy I just mentioned. Possibly the most
and
Alan
Steph,
Partridge.
You were there recently as well, weren't you?
I was there very recently at Wembley Stadium for the All Elite Wrestling All-In largest wrestling event I think the UK has ever had. So, yeah, in the past month, I've been to Wembley to see a guy get kebab skewers stuck in his head and to see Joe Hisaishi. It's been a wild time for me visiting Wembley.
So here's a question. Which had the most passionate crowd of the two?
Oh, wrestling, 100%.
But this is Wembley Arena, which is next door, which is a little smaller, but it still holds, what, 12,000 people? And you get off the tube and you sort of are funneled towards these venues. We sort of
Wembley
foolishly...
Way, Michael, you walk up Wembley Way.
Sorry, with the lined with statues of champions as you approach. We foolishly thought we might bump into each other beforehand, but then you realise that you're also in the scrummer for 11,000 people, and even when you once you go through
and
the
no
box
one
office,
can get any phone reception.
Yeah. But that set that scene. I saw some people in cosplay, but maybe less than I expected. I don't know. It was a pretty classy crowd from what I could see.
Yeah, well, I mean, much love to Joe, but this was not a cheap ticket. And so I think maybe it was a Friday night, people were wearing their fancy Totoro t-shirts. And it was very lovely to just walk in among that crowd. And I've done that Wembley Way walk where I've been wearing football shirts and you're with you're a kin of yours, I suppose. And you're walking up to the arch or to the arena. And I did kind of have that feeling, because it is like I can't escape feeling like a football fan when I walk there. But then getting there and seeing all the T-shirts, and it, like, to me, they suddenly just turned into football kits. And it was just like, OK, right. Oh, that's the away kit from 2003. And that, but imagine that's a No Face T-shirt or a Totoro T-shirt. And it just suddenly felt like that warmth that I get when I go to a game as well, where you suddenly feel like everyone is so invested in here. We are supporting the team, and the team happens to be this wonderful composer and his orchestra. And there was incredible warmth the moment you stepped off the tube. It was lovely.
Ghibli football kit would go hard, I think.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, absolutely would.
And so I haven't been to a classical performance on this scale ever. I don't think there are very many that you can have on this scale outside of John Williams, perhaps. Steph, are you about to say that you had been to one with an orchestra on this size?
Well, I was just thinking, because I don't think I'd been to any kind of classical adjacent stuff pre-pandemic. So I think my first kind of concert back was to see the Final Fantasy VII score performed at the Royal Albert Hall. Mm-hmm. That was, I think, one of my first like forays into that. So that was quite big. And then I saw Hans Zimmer this year at the O2, which I guess is a similar size.
Yeah, okay.
A little bit bigger than Wembley, I think. Yeah. But a very different vibe from this. I mean, Joe Hisaishi wasn't walking down into the crowd with an electric guitar. So, yeah.
I do wonder how many could have like a five-figure audience and Hans Zimmer, I guess, because he is stadium rock soundtracks. He could actually make that work. John Williams and Joe. I wonder if there are many others beyond that. Because I'd seen stuff at the Barbican, Royal Albert Hall. You know, I'd been to things in Manchester as well when I was growing up, seeing classical performances, but it's a very different vibe. But it was really still, I hadn't been to a gig this large since the pandemic. So it was really something walking out into the seats and it being a mass of people waiting for this performance to begin.
Here's a question for you. How do you feel about watching Joe Hisaishian eating a hot dog?
Or nachos? Yeah.
I guess if it didn't smell as much, I think I'd be more okay with it. But it was like when you've got these lovely, tender little moments in the concert, which we'll get into later. And I did notice this as soon as we walked in. It's like, oh, I'm so excited for there's the onions. And there they are. And that's going to be there all night. So that they did that gave it its rock concert feel in a way. And I am back at the football. So maybe I shouldn't complain.
You should have brought your Bovril and your pie.
Yeah. Imagine giving Joe Hisaishi a Bovril.
Having a pie in the interval would have been quite nice, actually.
The interval wasn't very long, though. It wasn't long enough. Speaking of which, before we get to the gig itself, the programme of music, did you have a chance to see any of the merch stands on your travels? Because I didn't actually
see one. No, we
went
looking for them, but we couldn't find them.
And I heard at the end of the night that they just sold out pretty much everything. They sold, like, hundreds of copies of the vinyl edition of the thing he's just put out, the Symphonic Celebration album that Deutsche Grammophon have just put out, and they sold out their entire stock. And on the tube back, I saw somebody clutching two copies like it was their newborn child for the trip back. But I imagine there was some on our way in when we were getting our sort of bag searched and everything. There was two young women in front of me, and they opened up their bags and it was full of Ghibli stuff. They must have been on Ghibli pilgrimage during the day. Mm-hmm. And then somewhere in the line, someone said, oh, the merch stand. And then they went, oh, there's merch. So I think the right crowd for as much merch as you could throw
at
them.
We must have walked past it.
You were too busy with the nachos and the hot dogs.
Slamming them out of people's hands.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So we take our seats, a hush overwhelms the audience, and then there's all of the tuning up and the clattering of the instruments, and then a small figure walks on stage, a sprightly short figure for a 72-year-old man, and that's Joe Hisaishi, and the concert begins. So how should we do this? Should we talk through some of the set list?
We'll sing it all for you now.
So Steph's got the...
I'll do the woodwind.
You can do the woodwinds. I'll clatter out the percussion. So I was surprised at the way that it was done as a programme of music. Like, you had suites from each film. I hadn't really looked at set lists beforehand. I wanted to be surprised. And I suppose that is the best way to do it, considering the way that these... You realise very quickly how beautifully and gracefully and but subtly the whole programme of music as a set list shows just how diverse he can be, how polystylist he can be. Between the scores, they focus on different areas of the orchestra, different soloists, different tones and sounds. So I suppose the only way you could do it, rather than mixing it all up in a shuffle playlist, would be to have suites. And I did wonder to begin with what the route through the filmography would be. Sort of the way that right back at the beginning of the podcast, we thought, how would we go through the Ghibli filmography? How would you do it musically? And I did wonder, the first film was the first film. It started with Nausicaa. And I was like, what do you think that'd be chronological? How would that work? But I suppose we start with Nausicaa, which is... I remember, was that a highlight for you, Jake, when we did the film?
Yeah, I like Nausicaa a lot. And I like the music a lot. I think I wrote about this in the book, but I love how wild that music is. That at one point it sounds like John Williams' Superman score, and it's full of kind of symphonic bombast. It's huge. And then the next, it's like a Giorgio Moroder produced Donna Summer disco remix. And I love that about that score. And not to be super critical or anything, and I loved what was played. I would have loved a bit of the weirdness, because it was a symphony and it was just an orchestra. We couldn't bring in that early synth strangeness that's there in Nausicaa and Castle in the Sky. So I would have loved to have heard that. But I thought Nausicaa was a really lovely way to set the tone. Obviously, it is the first film. You're immediately kind of nostalgic for it. But it also kind of sets you up for telling the story of Joe in a way. And that we can come in here at chapter one. And then we're going to bounce around, but we're going to foreground you here. Like, this is the starting point. And so you can hear we've gone on this journey from this point. So, yeah, very lovely. And I think kind of establishing how the show was going to work, because none of us knew that it was going to be these suites. And really, that was how it played out. Generally, each one was around 10 minutes. But then you had some shorter ones that probably came in at 6. And then some that stretched out to maybe 13, 15. A great tone setter. But then set-wise, I would say that he knew what he was doing. And he did keep most of the hits in the pocket for the second half. It is a game of two halves. We are at Wembley.
Yeah, it was kind of... I think he saved some of the crowd favourites for the second half. But I think a lot of the first half actually got me, and I was thinking about some of the first half music a little bit more kind of the next day. Mostly because he did Ponyo in the first half, and I think Ponyo is so beautiful. Did make me shed a little tear, a few tears. And like also the
full
Wind Rises
choir going Ponyo,
yeah.
Ponyo, Ponyo, fishy in the sea. And this very serious choir, like, having to say fishy in the sea.
But they committed to it, didn't they? And I suppose that's the interesting thing, is whether they were going to sing the English language or Japanese language lyrics. Mm-hmm. And sometimes there were the songs where they did sing in Japanese. And then, but for Ponyo, English language lyrics, and they are so wonderfully daft.
Well, and you have that kind of, yeah, the like the silly Ponyo song, but then you also have that beautiful, like, operatic
the solo opening credits song,
for the opening credits. And there was a mixture of shots of the orchestra and of Joe Hisaishi obviously conducting, but then every now and again they would play a clip from the film, and that was a nice moment where you had those kind of lovely opening credits images playing over the top.
So Steph, when you saw Hans, did they have clips from the film, and how did they sync that up in, like, sync sound in any way? Or
I don't remember there being clips from the films. It was more just like the vibe, like lighting, some imagery, but not necessarily full kind of scenes. Mm-hmm. It was more just like, okay, we're doing Top Gun, so it's going to be, you know, lasers and some like red smoke, and it's going to be awesome, like that kind of vibe, more than like, yeah, seeing clips from the film. So this was yeah, a little bit different, just because there wasn't really that.
Yeah, I was really struck by how restrained it was. Like, you get a little clip of the film just to almost situate you in the context, but it was still very much a celebration of the music. And as you say, it's not like they were performing completely to a screen of clips from the films. I'd probably say the clips from the films were maybe even 40% of what you'd see. Mostly it would be shots of the orchestra, close-ups of Joe when he's conducting and when he's performing on the piano as well. And it just really did put that focus on performance and a real atmosphere and aura of collaboration and joy in performance. The amount of times where he'd be hitting a moment in a piece of music where there's a particular, I don't know, tricky run or a little, you know, flurry somewhere in the orchestra, and he'd like point or look at them and he would smile and he would be clearly enjoying it himself. That really struck me, though, even though it's taking the music and the performance of the music very seriously, it's also enjoying it. And in that way that Ghibli films are so well realized, but there is just that element of magic that makes you want to take elements of that film and put it within your real life. Mm-hmm. That was there as well. It really made it feel human. There was a human touch to it that maybe if it was, not to say that they would ever consider putting in lasers and smoke machines into a Ghibli performance, but it just really felt very, kind of like the Totoro show, really well put together, but it had that human touch and human element that feels unmistakably Ghibli.
Yeah, I think because when you go to see something like that, you're not going to watch clips from the film, because you could just go and see the film in the cinema or watch it at home. Like, you want to see people's hands like on the instruments, and you want to see the emotion that's on like the musicians' faces when they're playing that music, or when they're singing it. So I think, yeah, you need to have that kind of human contact behind it, for sure.
Well, and the only real moments of kind of technical wizardry was, I think, for one song, there was the lights turned red in the house, and then another song where it was just Joe on the piano, which we'll get to later, he just had a spotlight, and those are the only two times that the lighting in the room changed. And I think, yeah, as you said, that shows confidence. But Steph, you mentioned it, I interrupted you, but the Wind Rises, which was a first half highlight, which I don't think anyone really expected to have as much an impact as it did, because it was really understatedly introduced, where you just had a nice looking older gentleman walk onto stage and sit down, and then the moment that you register, he's got a mandolin that they're just kind of a little murmur floats around the arena. You think this could only be one thing, and like The Wind Rises is a lovely score, and it has these big soaring moments, and there's so much kind of majesty to it, but that opening is the most memorable bit of it. It's so simple and so lovely. It's so different to everything else. And we talked so much on the podcast about the European influence of Ghibli, or the European influence that Ghibli have had. And like, you hear that there, you are transported immediately both to that film and to a sunny, beautiful European setting. And all of a sudden, we've felt autumn coming in this week, and watching this performance did feel like you're back in the heat of summer, and it's very lovely. And between Wind Rises and Porco Rosso, they were these wonderfully simplified songs on a very big occasion, and those were two of the things that really struck me.
I'd love to know if anybody hadn't seen The Wind Rises though before that show, and then went home to watch it, because the use of clips in that was very interesting. Like, if you'd never seen that, you'd be like, this is a lovely film about a man who flies a plane and it's windy. Sounds great. Mm. Like,
and interesting choice. Lovely girlfriend, and everything works out well.
Well, that was the one that surprised me because, yeah, sometimes when you have clips and they're playing a suite and you hear a bit of music, and then because that's one where, of course, it starts off with the beautiful mandolin theme, that soaring romantic theme, and they mostly just played the romantic themes, didn't they? Mm-hmm. But there was the bit where it's them on the train and it's nice catch and the hat being blown off his head and everything, but we know what happens next. It's like, are they going to then go into the earthquake? What's going to go on? No, actually, they just made it this beautiful romantic suite, and that was the one that got me out of all of them. That was the one that really gave me chills, because I think that's such a beautiful piece of music and a beautiful film. And it came hot on the heels of Kiki's Delivery Service and Mononoke, so they started with some big ones. I can't remember where The Interval landed, but was it Wind Rises, Ponyo, then The Interval, or was it Castle in the Sky, then The Interval?
I think it ended after Ponyo, because that was like a nice big kind of triumphant but thing then to end on.
You say there wasn't much in the way of big moves, Jake, but one I did like was for Porco Rosso, where they just stripped back the orchestra just to basically the horn section, the brass, and Joe
at
the
piano. Well, that's what I mean about simplicity. Yeah,
absolutely simplicity. And he took off his jacket and was like, this is the bit where we're in the bar. And each of the, you know, the brass players got their little moment in that piece as well. And as I said, yeah, it really shows off that there is a love of performance and instruments and music at the heart of this. It's not just the melodies, because we've talked about this before, where like it feels that Joe's melodies are as much a character or as much a play a role in the success of the films, but the concert wasn't playing it like a jukebox, like these are just the melodies. It really did want you to almost more than anything appreciate the musicianship as well behind it.
Well, and for like the not pantomime, but the very kind of low stakes theatrical staging of the event, part of what made it so charming was that it was all going back to the word again, the simplicity of it, that when we saw that for one song that a section of the orchestra had been put up in the seats, that was so exciting. That was like, oh my god! Oh, how have they done? Like it's like the Prestige where Hugh Jackman appears up in the rafters after using the teleportation device. Oh, how have they done it? It's like, well, there was an interval and they just walked up there. But it was that everyday magic that we so often talk about on this podcast.
And then, so the second half is where probably what they believe are the big hitters come out. That's Howl's Moving Castle, Spirited Away, Totoro. So any comments on those three? We should say that as well as the red-shoed mandolin soloist, there were two incredible vocal soloists. The two sopranos, Ella Taylor, who did some absolutely some of those high notes in some of the in some of the scores, they were singing that, and it's just being in the presence of somebody who could sing complicated vocal lines that high was really stunning. And then Grace Davidson as well coming in on a little more human level of singing, but no less astonishing as a soprano. But any comments on those final few before the encore came around?
We've said on the podcast before that we think Howl's Moving Castle is a muddled film. But this performance made me have a lot more respect for Joe's ambition with the score on it. Because I think out of everything that we heard, that was the one that went off in the most varied directions. There is so much variety in that score. And like Merry-Go-Round of Life, the open, it feels you're kind of in familiar territory. Like you felt like you've heard a Joe score like that, even in Spirited Away or something. But then it zips around doing all manner of crazy things, which feels appropriate to, I suppose, all the magic doors of Howl's Castle opening up in all these different places and sending you out into different parts of the world. And because it was so compact that you had to he didn't have the hour 50 of the film or whatever to gradually wind in between these different tracks, and it had to be condensed to this suite. That one felt quite like jumbled in the best way, that you really didn't know from minute to minute where it was going to go next. So yeah, I didn't expect Howl's to be a highlight in that respect for me.
I'm going basic. Totoro was my favourite in the second half. Just so good to hear again a jolly kids song, but fully backed by an orchestra live score. Yeah, it took me back to the first time I saw that film, which was at the kind of Somerset House Film for Summer Screen many years ago, and just not knowing what to expect, never having seen a Ghibli film before, and then just seeing those kind of opening credits of the bouncing Totoro characters coming across the screen, just really, yeah, took me back to kind of where it all began, why I love it so much. Yeah, and just the power of like what you could easily brush off as like a kid's song, just being so beautiful and well arranged and sung.
That's the Totoro song where they really pulled out all the stops and they all came back on stage for that.
Yeah.
But like they even had Hey Let's Go, the opening credits theme. And I did wonder, having seen the Barbican show a year ago, how this would compare. But of course, the Barbican uses its ensemble really well, and its singers, it has an identity of its own. This was much more symphonic in that sense. I'll say, Jake, that like I love the synth weirdness of like the Path of the Wind theme, that you know, I wouldn't expect Joe to get out his guitar, run into the crowd like his Hans Zimmer, banging out the synth parts.
Well, it did mean that we got no lovely cat bus.
They should have got you on stage.
But that's like, what do you do with Totoro's like Indiana Jones, where there is so many melodies that for everyone that is the theme tune, and so you can only play so much. But it was such a lovely, rousing end to the concert. What we thought was the ender.
So the encore.
Plural encores.
Four several encores.
Because this is the thing about Joe, is that even within receiving the applause, he'll bow himself, bring out the soloist, point out individual pals in the orchestra, and then the chorus, and then go off, and then come back, and then do it all over again, and then there's an encore. And we knew this from the previous night, because we went on the second night, that there was a nice surprise. And he comes out with a microphone and he says that he was going to play a piece from The Boy and the Heron, the new Hayao Miyazaki film, that's called Ask Me Why. And that was a gorgeous piano solo piece, wasn't it? Or at least the majority of it was.
That was where I cried.
Oh.
Yeah. I found it, I don't know, I think because it felt so intimate. Because it was just on the piano, and it was all of these people, and it felt, because this was when he spoke as well, and he spoke in this slightly broken English, and you could feel his connection just in those short words, not just to the music and to the film, but to Miyazaki as well. And you could see as he was playing the piano, like his eyes were slightly welled up, and there was a tremble in his fingers because he was nervous to play it. And at the end of the song, he like jokingly mopped his head because of fear of having not played that one as much as all the others. And all of that kind of suddenly showed this vulnerability and intimacy and but passion as well, that still at this point in his career and in his 70s, doing this work and still being that nervous and that close to it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the combination of all of that and the fact that the song is beautiful. Like, it's so wistful. It's kind of, it's romantic. And it's something that I can't wait to see in context. I suppose that was the strange thing. No one in that room knew what images to put with this. And I think that kind of almost added to it. There was no projection that you could have behind. So you had nothing to associate with. So all you could do was focus on the music, and it just kind of exists in the theatre of the mind. And it was, really, it's quite something.
Yeah, it was, as you said, because it was the looks on his face and the way he, when he was, because it was quite a complicated one with lots of very fast runs on the right hand, and he'd be like flexing his left hand during it, like he was cramping up, because I guess he'd been performing, both conducting and playing piano for 2 hours by that point. And it was, astonishing and beautiful piece of music, as you say. I do wonder if there are any of those hardcore no promo people who stormed out at that point and went, oh, he's spoiling the film for us. Toshio Suzuki said no promo.
Now we know there'll be music in it.
Now we know that there'll be yet another amazing Joe Hisaishi score. And what was surprising then was after that encore, then he launched back into bits from films that were in the first half, which were quite surprising then. You didn't have the safety net of any clips to situate where you were. He threw in Porco Rosso, the particularly crazy, maybe suitably crazy piece that's called Madness from Porco Rosso, which is one of those, it's really dynamic, that piece of music. It's a real whirlwind of a piece.
Oh yeah, at this point it's like the last 10 minutes of Whiplash. The cameras in the stadium are like doing extreme close-ups on Joe's eyes. He's gradually raising his hands, trying to get the drummer involved. Everyone's sweating profusely, wondering what might happen next. And then it just cuts to black and everyone leaves.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was Porco Rosso into... And then we went back to Mononoke, which I thought was a great call, because in the first half, the Mononoke section in the moment felt weirdly short.
Yeah. But, yeah, just pitch perfect, really. And what was amazing about the whole thing, we've said this, I think we've said this before, but I've never really, we've never felt it because we've never been to one of these concerts. The great, so in these years where Miyazaki has become less public and he's not gone, you know, he's also never really been around the world with one of his films in the time when the films have got this new level of appreciation, this new generation that have found the films in the decades since The Wind Rises, or the 5 years or so since they went on Netflix. There's been no way to publicly express our adulation, our love, to share in the joy. And so Joe is the standard bearer for that. He goes out and does these concerts, and there's nowhere you can experience the joy of Ghibli with 11,000 people, but that's what that room was. And you could really feel this, even though maybe it wasn't as much as a wrestling a night of the wrestling,
no kebab skewers,
you could still feel when there was any round of applause that people were standing up, they were banging the chairs, they really wanted to let their emotions be heard, because this is how to release that, because we'll never get to do this to Miyazaki in public. He won't be going and appearing on Sunday brunch or the One Show for The Boy and the Heron. Although let's wait and see.
That would be so funny.
This is the so much of the mystique and
food heaven or food hell, I hope.
In some ways, the crafted mystique of Ghibli and Miyazaki is the fact that it's so rarefied and distant and on the other side of the world and reclusive. So it's such so out of the ordinary to be able to be in a public space and enjoy that stuff. So, yeah, what an amazing concert for that.
Well, and so everyone gave him another big hand, but Michael, there was another hand that was extended to Joe, was there not, after the concert finished?
Are you talking about this thing I'm very embarrassed about? So I
would you like to tell us what happened after the concert finished.
I was very fortunate. I should say thank you to Rachel, who invited me along. And when we got there, we found out we had backstage tickets. And after the concert, I mean, it's not like we went backstage at a Metallica gig or some major stadium gig where there's a whole circus backstage. But we went backstage and there was just a corridor with all the rooms. And I suppose, what would you want Joe Hisaishi to be like backstage? He had just invited all the performers and everyone else involved just into his changing room. It was all very down to earth. He was there leaning on the wall in the corridor with a beer, chatting away with everybody. And he did come over. I was introduced to him as a journalist, but he heard that I was German. And then he told me how he had just been conducting Mahler's Fifth Symphony, which was very like I just stepped into a very different version of Tar to what was released in cinemas a year ago. And I shook his hand and I just said, thank you for the evening and thank you for the music, to quote ABBA. But that was very brief. But I think on behalf of the project that we've done together, but also my love of the films, that was quite a nice little moment to have with the man. Because again, we don't get the chance to meet these people. They're quite reclusive. We've tried to get him on the podcast with the Barbican Show and all that, and I don't think he does much press. But that was lovely.
How much like Wayne's World did it feel?
Oh, the We Are Not Worthy. Unfortunately, my leg had given out and I wouldn't be able to do any bowing that evening. But it did, you know, I had to, you know, maintain some composure. I was being introduced as a serious journalist. And on either side of him, there was the president of Decca Records and the president of Deutsche Grammophon. So it was quite a swanky conversation to be eavesdropping on. So I couldn't go full fanboy. But it was it was really great.
Good, good.
And did you meet any icons of stage and screen that evening?
Michael, I'm glad you asked. listeners expecting more Hisaishi chat can turn off now. But Steph and I, we literally were not worthy. We were not allowed backstage. So we went to the nearest drinking hole after the venue to let the traffic to the tube die down. We just thought this would be nice, quiet point, debrief, you know, have a chat. Maybe we'll get Michael on the way out. And we stumble into this venue. And what do we find except Sean Williamson, otherwise known as Barry from popular English soap EastEnders, conducting Barry-oke, which is a karaoke night in which any song that you select, you go and sing with Barry from EastEnders live on stage. And there was a massive projection of the karaoke, so everyone in the venue could sing along. And I never thought my night would begin with Joe Hisaishi and end with watching Barry from EastEnders sing Daydream Believer.
He had a beautiful voice. We didn't get
he
to
genuinely
meet him,
could sing, yeah. Yeah, he could sing. But, you know, listeners, if you do want more of a deep dive into Sean Williamson, Barry Oakey, EastEnders, all that, do let us know on the Discord, which, of course, you can sign up to as a patron to the podcast at patreon.com/Ghibliotech. I'm sure that's what you want more of on the show.
Are you suggesting we have a Lie Barry Cafe?
Hey, that's good.
Oh dear, yes, that's the sort of level of humour and insight you can expect on our Patreon bonus episodes. Go to patreon.com/Ghibliotech to find out all about that.
Yes, at the time of recording, we've just done one that we went all in different directions, Michael, where we covered The Bear and Ozu and Dumb Money all in the same episode.
And Smoke Sauna Sisterhood as well. So yes, a very diverse selection of screen media for us to chat about. I've really enjoyed doing this podcast with you three. This is great. We should do more on the main feed.
Do more concert reviews.
So, Steph, you need to take us on a deep dive into wrestling as well. Next.
All right. I can do that. I'm watching it weekly now, so get ready.
Wrestling podcasting seems like a big area.
I'm sure there are many.
And listeners, Maybe you were at Joe as well. We'd love to hear what you made of the evening. We saw so many pictures from people on Twitter, but please send us a note, and it would be great to hear how the evening went for you. You can send us tweets on Twitter/X at Ghibliotech. We're also on Instagram, ghibliotech.pod. We do have a TikTok account as well, ghibliotech.pod. There's not much on there right now, but when we go to Japan at the end of October, maybe we'll do some more while we're out there. You can also follow us all individually. You have Jake on Twitter at Jake H. Cunningham and on Instagram at jake.h.cunningham.
You can follow Steph on Twitter at _StephWatts and on Instagram at TigerMothEmbroidery.
And you can follow Michael at MichaelJLeader and Michael.Leader on Instagram. Ghibliotech is produced by Michael Leader, Jake Cunningham, Harold McShiel, and Steph Watts. Our music is by Anthony Ng.